recording session number 10602, reel 26.
Reel 26. You were just telling me at the end of the last reel that of an incident that happened at a cathedral town, Everon or Evero.
Yeah.
Could you continue with your story?
Well, we'd just arrived. The general was there on a visit for some reason or other. I never knew what his visits were. But I was there on one of the rare occasions when I went out with him as a bodyguard. And when the car stopped, the driver got out first, as we used to take turns, and sometimes he would say, "I'll do it this time," or "Are you doing it?" And Charlie just got out and came around the front of the car when there was a shower of stones, pebbles and things came, and I shouted to him, "Get down behind the car and I'll see to it." And I went to the bonnet of the car and I levelled my rifle. It was already loaded. I moved the safety catch off, and I think the civilians who'd seen it saw what I was going to do when they ran away, so I knew there was no reason to put a round over their heads or anything.
That's what you intended to do, was it? Not shoot actually at them?
No, not the first time, but if they'd continued to throw stones while the general was in the vehicle, I would have fired at them. I would have fired to wound, I wouldn't have fired to kill. I would have tried the legs or the arms. But if they persisted in it, I would have fired to kill. The general was my responsibility and I would have done that. Explanations after would have been taken by anybody else. But my prime thoughts at that moment was the general. And the general was more important than me.
And why do you think you have this incident? Why do you think they have thrown stones?
I haven't a clue. It was the first time I'd ever been in the place. I have no idea why, because the few French people I had met up till then, although not welcoming with open arms, were not antagonistic to us.
Did the general express any opinion?
No, I think he was a little surprised, but he just got on with it. He just got out of the car when he saw it was over and just went on. He never even remarked about it.
When the general went to one of these meetings, what did you do?
Stay with the car, or if the general said to the driver, come back in an hour's time or go and get a meal, we would go and get a meal and a coffee.
Were your headquarters always at Belmontaigne when you were there?
Oh no, we had headquarters at a small village called Quovaux-Villiers. We were there for a short while, and then we had another headquarters for a short while in Lons, and then we proceeded from Lons to a suburb of Lille called Luz, but the French pronounce it as Los. And there was a chateau there which was the DVHQ mess. That's where all the staff officers were. I'm not quite sure where the dining room was there. I think it was the dining room was in the same place, yes. But where the divisional administration officers were, I'm not sure. But most of the staff were in this chateau. In Luz, or Los, a suburb of Lille, and we were there until the fireworks started.
Okay. Well, during that time, was there any incidents that you were involved in that you can recall?
There was one incident. I think it might be worth recalling. Joe Gort, my old mate, had come to 50 DVHQ as a batman to some other officer, and him and I used to go, when we used to go out, we would go out together, we would walk around, or when we went for meals, we would go to our mess room to get meals from our own cooks. But almost every day we used to go into a little fruit and vegetable shop, and we may buy an apple, or we may buy an orange, or we may buy a banana at tea time, but to supplement the tea meal. And I don't know that, I didn't know the name of the family, but when they found that we went every day, they began to try and talk to us in English, and their English was worse than our French. So we tried, and we became friends with the man, the owner, his wife, and the daughter. She's a very little girl, and we became very friendly with them. And then one day the man said, would you two like to come with me to go to the place where I buy all my fruit and vegetables? Well, we just couldn't answer yes or no straight away, you see, because when you're a general's batman, you just cannot pick and choose what you can do. And I said to the man, I said, well, look, I said, I'll ask the general if I can have the time off during the day, and if you tell me the time when you want me away, it'll be easier. And I spoke to the general that night, and I was telling him about Joe and I going to this little shop and what had happened. He says, I think that's a brilliant idea. He says, I haven't heard of many of these things where the French people have taken to soldiers like this. And he says, it's good for public relations. He says, ah, he says, I think it's a good idea. He said, you go back and tell them you'll go. You can go. He says, you and your mate can go. I'll see to it. So we were due to go. I went back and saw the man, and he said, well, on such and such a date, I think it was in May, it might have been April or May 1940, we could go with him if we were at his place at a certain time. Between him making the date and the day he should have gone, that man collapsed and died. So we never got. Now then, the widow started to keep the shop going, keep the little business going, because that's all she had, poor soul. We never stopped going to that shop. We still kept going as if, you know, it was normal. And we bought our little things, and we did become quite friendly with the lady. She was a nice person, and the daughter used to, you know, she used to gobble away 50 to the dozen in French. And we couldn't understand her, but I think we spoiled her a little bit. She was cunning.
You mentioned a moment ago that you had to ask the general's permission, obviously, to be excused any possible times that he needed you. Was it difficult for you to get rest periods away from your duties as a batman?
Let's put it this way. I cannot say yes or no to that, for the simple reason I always considered my duty was to the general, and he was a good general. He was also a soldier's general, which makes him a little bit higher than maybe some others. I met a few others later on that, but he was a soldier's general, and he was a good general.
What do you mean by a soldier's general?
He looked after his men. I can give you another incident about him. One or two incidents. One incident would be enough, never mind about any more. But his ways and his attitudes. He always would speak to a man. If he passed a soldier, he was as likely to say good morning to him, or good evening, when the soldier saluted him. He would always, you know, and he would have a cheerful countenance. I cannot ever recall him being gloomy. And he would look after his men, and I can know of an instant where he did. He played well with the commander-in-chief. But that's a little bit later on. I always placed the general first, me second. And I never thought it was an imposition, whatever duty I had to do to him. I was a soldier. I was being paid a soldier's pay. There was a war on. The general was a good man. And an incident, when I said I went to the general, and he gave me 3 months probation, and I gave him three months probation, if you like, the way he said it at the beginning. When that 3 months came up, we were in Lille itself. And I said to him one morning, the morning of the 3 months up. I says, you know, sir, that 3 months probation's up. I said, do I stay or do I have to go? He says, Elliot, I forgot about that after the first 3 weeks. I says, and you didn't tell me? He said, no. He said, if I told you, you might have slackened. I says, that's not being fair. You know, I could talk to him when it was little things like that. You could talk to him. He would listen. But he was still a good man. Make no mistake about that. He was a good man.
Yeah, you mentioned moments ago that there was a story that you could...
Well, then, when the war really started, the night, you see, a couple of, maybe the next night, or shortly after when the heavy bombardment started, which was the beginning of the end, if you like, of the BEF, there was a young officer, an intelligence officer, from one of the units, came on a motorbike with a specific message for the general. Now, the general and the staff were down at dinner. They were sat down at dinner. And I was sent for by the staff. I was waiting on, by the way. But I was sent by the staff sergeant to attend to this young officer. And I went out and asked him what he wanted. He said, I have an urgent message for the general. I said, all right. And I went to the general and I said, there's an intelligence officer just come, sir. And he has a very important emergency message for you. Oh, he says, well, I'll go out and see him then. And he came out of the mess room and saw this young officer. And when the young officer saw the general, I think it was fatigue more than anything else of the young officer. But he wasn't quite clear with the message he was giving the general. The general turned around, he said, just a moment. He says, what's your name? And he told him his name. He says, staff? No, he said, when did you last have a meal? He said, I can't remember when I last had a meal, sir. He said, it's a long time ago since I had one. The general turned around to the staff sergeant. He says, staff, do you think you could provide another dinner? He said, yes, sir. He said, well, set a place for Mr. He knew his name then, Mr. So-and-so. He's going to have dinner with us. And this officer, put the message. He says, forget about the message. He says, you haven't eaten for a long while? He says, no. He said, well, come in. He says, have a meal with me. He took him in and he gave him his dinner. I think that was the first meal the lad had had maybe for a couple of days. And when he finished, the general said, right. He said, now then, if you could remember the message you had to give me before you had your dinner, you might give me it now. And the lad was as clear as a bell when he gave the message. Where before he'd had the meal, he'd been, I think, afraid of the rank of the general rather than anything else. And the general, I said to the general that night, I said, why did you do that to that young officer? Why did you offer him a meal? He says, Elliot, if he'd given me that message there and then, he said it would have been no good. He says, because I wouldn't have got a clear message from him. He says, once he relaxed and had a meal, he says he was a changed person.
Can you recall what the message was?
No, I wasn't there when he was given it, you see. But that was what I mean by a soldier's general. Now then, another time, when we were in, we left Lille, we went into Belgium. I can't say where in Belgium, but we went into Belgium. We came out of Belgium, we were back into France. We went from France back into Belgium again. From Belgium we came back into France to Vimy Ridge, or the Vimy Village, where we were under constant air attack. We went from there again, back into Belgium, and when we went into Belgium last time, I was given orders, as I was then a lance corporal. You might ask me the reason why later on. I was IC of the 50 Div Advance Forces, the DVHQ troops. I was the only general duties NCO there. There was no one else. and I was in charge of 3 tonners and all the men that was there with them. And I was given an order to get to a certain place. The instructions I had was get to as near Brussels as you can. Well, we were in Belgium. I know quite certain we just passed the large First Time War Cemetery of Dickiebusch, and we came down that small road into a village, and there was a lot of refugees in the village, and I tried to get them to move off the road. I got out of the vehicle, a 3-tonner, and I went forward and I tried to get them so that I could get the transport through and as near onto Brussels as possible. They would not move. So I saw there was a gate in a field behind on the right hand side of the road, and I thought, well, I might be able to get through the fields rather than on the road. So I said to the driver, we'll go through the through here and we'll turn left and run parallel with the village road and see if we can get on, join the road further up. Well, we just got a few yards into the field when the enemy opened up with artillery, some sort of artillery, maybe tanks or something, but we were getting rounds, and I shouted to the driver, straight around, go back where we were. And I gave the instruction to the other transport that was following to get out and to get into a dip in the village. So we got back onto the road, and I ordered the drivers to take the vehicles and spread them out under trees, and I gave all the lads orders not to lie under a vehicle. I said, there's a ditch here. I said, there's a stream running through, and I said, there's a nice deep ditch. Get into the ditch, get below the level of the ground, and stay there until you get the next orders from me. So Joe Gort and I, the two regulars, went back into the village, and we hadn't got very far amongst the houses before we saw the German aircraft coming again. They were dropping bombs and they were strafing the village street. So Joe and I dived into the side of the road to get below the level of the ground. When he looked up and he shouted, Joe was just in front of me, and he said, Geordie, there's a woman with a baby in her hands. And next second he was up, he grabbed the baby, threw the baby to me to catch. Azad was following him, as he was in front of me, and he went first, now followed him. He grabbed the baby, threw the baby at me, I caught the baby, run to the ditch, and I covered the baby with my body. He grabbed the woman, pulled her over, and he covered her body with his body. And we'd barely got down before there was holes appeared in the, like, cement, concrete walls they had, that kind of concrete walls for the end of the gardens, or the houses. And just above our heads there was a row of where bullets had gone through, or shells from the aircraft. And we could, and then the bomb started dropping, we were lifted and dropped up and down just like yo-yos on the ground. Well, when the bombing stopped, we got the woman onto her feet and we gave her the baby back, and we pointed to a house, because we couldn't speak Belgium, we pointed to a house and pointed to the woman and the baby and all the others, the other refugees, to go back home. We said, you know, we're pointing to them, we're pointing to the houses, and you go back home. And they wouldn't, so they kept coming. And Joe looked around, he says, oh lad, he said, there's our 3-tonner on fire. And it was the wagon which had petrol and the spare ammunition. So we run away from the refugees, Joe and I, and from another vehicle I grabbed a fire extinguisher. He went to another one, grabbed a fire extinguisher, and when we got to the burning truck, he said, oh lad, he said, there's one of the lads underneath. He says, he's badly wounded. He says, cover me with the spray from the fire extinguisher. He said, I'll go in and get him out. So Joe went underneath the 3-tonner, and mind, this was a 1-1 petrol and ammunition. And he went down and he pulled the lad out, but when he pulled him out, the lad was dead. He'd been riddled. And we just put the fire out, and that was it. So when I met the assistant commandant later, some days later, I said to him, I think your private goat should be mentioned either in dispatches or given a decoration for what he did. He'd offer his life twice in a matter of seconds. And the surprising answer I got from the officer was, "What is the regiment's motto?" I said, "Faithful." He said, "That's it." He says, "That's what you get you paid your daily wage for doing things like that." And I said, "Oh well, all right." So that was that. I'd recommended him because I thought he had done two brave deeds without hesitation, offered his life twice for others, and he got nothing. Anyhow,
did you feel angry about that?
Yes, I felt angry. After what I've read of other people getting decorations and people who get made lords and whatever in peacetime, yes, I feel very bitter about it. I thought Joe should have had at least a military medal or a DCM for what he did.
Did you think of mentioning it to General Martel?
No. You don't do that. You don't do that. You go to your next superior officer.
What I'd like to do now is to look at the movements, perhaps from when the German invasion of France started, and say what you did. I mean, you mentioned that, in fact, you were moving back and forth across the French-Belgian border. But can you tell me a little bit about, generally, what you were doing at that time?
Well, moving from one point to another point to set up an HQ.
Were you always under attack, or was it...
Almost. Almost. If you weren't under artillery attack, you were under air attack. There wasn't a day went by when you were in it.
Did you have any idea how the war was going?
None. We knew it was going badly. We knew we weren't going forward, so we knew where when we were coming back it was. Now, at one time, when we came back to the village of Vimy Village, I'm not sure which time this was, but we came back to Vimy Village, and I'm not sure it was the 8th or the 9th battalions of the Durhams were there at the same time, and we were under constant heavy attack. You can nearly put your hands out and shake hands with the pilots of the aircraft over that low. Well, I was with the general this particular time, but the infantry were firing the rifles, and it was dangerous for the men on the ground rather than the aircraft. They were losing discipline, really. And he said to me, "Elliot," he said, "pop along there," he said, "and see who's in charge of that lot, and try and put them right about the discriminate shooting." So I went along to them, and the only answer I got from them, and the men were very, very angry, I said, "Well, first," I said, "have you got your sights set right on your rifles?" And I got a mouthful. Who the world was I to tell them what to do? He says, "Not me." I says, "The general's just over there." And I said, "He's asked me to come along and find out why you're firing over quite close to the vehicles instead of firing the aircraft." Well, when the aircraft were low. So it was quite feasible that it was happening. Anyhow, the lads had seen something I hadn't seen, and that said, using some really swear words and foul words, "You seen what them so-and-sos have done to them women and kids down there or somewhere else?" I said, "I've seen what's happened to some." I said, "I've been in it like you." He said, "Well, get away from me before we shoot through them." So
These were Durhams.
This was either the 8th or the 9th battalion. It wasn't the 6th, because they had bright buttons. The 6th had black. And anyway, I went back to the general, and I'd barely got back before he said, "We're moving again." It was that kind of thing. Now, we went back from there, I think, to the chateau in Lille. And while we were there, that night, the G1, I think it was Colonel Everett, the Royal Artillery, he was G Staff Officer 1, And he got me out of bed, and he said, "Will you get the general?" So I went, got out of bed, and got the general. And he was on the phone to the commander in chief of the BEF, Lord Gort, I think it was, somebody anyway. And he was demanding that he send his transport to a certain area to pick up some men and take me somewhere else. And General Martel turned around, he said, "I have given direct orders that all drivers of 50 div vehicles must have a minimum rest of so many hours," he says, "and that is going to be carried out." And he used the remark that if you people on the general staff had thought more about mechanisation instead of horses, we maybe wouldn't be in this situation we're in now. He says, "You can send machines, you can fuel them, oil them, repair them," he said, "but you can't use them without having human beings to drive them." He says, "My human drivers," he says, "are exhausted." He said, "And sir, if you can send the drivers, you can have the vehicles." He says, "My drivers is not coming out till they've had that rest." Now that is why I said to you earlier on, he was a soldier's general. And I think twice in that short period of time, there was clear proof of that. But I knew that without that proof, I knew he was a good bloke.
Can you recall the actual retreat back to Dunkirk?
Well, as I explained earlier, when we were in that village, when the three tunners, when we couldn't get through the village, we had to retreat then, and that was the last time we were in Belgium, and unknown to us, we were on our way to Dunkirk. And Luton was not permitted. Up till then, we had a French liaison officer. He was from the Alpine Chasseurs. He was a captain, but I forgot his name. He was a good liaison officer. Anyhow, we came to one village, and it was under more or less attack, and there was troops in the village streets firing Bren guns at the enemy, because that's all they had, rifles or Bren guns. And when I reported to the Captain Platt, I think his name was, that was the assistant commandant of 50 Div HQ, I was ordered to move to go further somewhere else. And anyhow, the village I came to, I think, was Armentières in the old-fashioned language, but Armentières. And there was no one, not a human being in that village. The stock was running around loose. And I had had no rations issued by the British Army for a long time. And I went to the captain and I asked him if I could use any of the stock or anything that was there in the village for to feed the men I was responsible for. And he said, "With effect from now, you can go into any village, any house, whatever you like," he said, "it'll not be classified as looting." So I got stuck in, and there was chickens, there was vegetables and everything else. And the only thing was I didn't know how to kill chickens and to plot them. And I was getting the vegetables and everything else ready, and one of the drivers came in. I knew he was the son of a butcher. And I said, "Brock," I said, I don't know anything about cleaning animals to make a meal with, and I've got permission to use them." He said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Wait, we could use a few chickens if we could get them cleaned and used properly." "Oh," he says, "no bother, lad." He said, "I'll do that for you." And within no time, we had a number of chickens in the pot, so we had a good meal going.
That, I should imagine, was quite a rare occurrence.
It was a rare occurrence getting a meal, let's put it that way. It was, you just got what you could, when you could. Now,
can you tell me about, you were in charge of this transport attached to divisional, yes, divisional headquarters, weren't you? Mm-hmm. What difficulties did you face in getting this transport back along the roads?
Well, we were always stopping, going undercover. As I say, I'd lost one three-tonner. There was no way I could bring that back. It was not possible to bring it back. I unloaded the stuff from it onto the other wagons. And I kept it until that was the only vehicle I lost, actually. And that private soldier that was killed, he was the only man I lost. I would pick up other lads, from lads who had been lost or, you know, just maybe withdrawn and got lost from the rest. They weren't